Welcome students from Amherst High School. Would they please stand? You may be seated. We hope you find this session interesting and informative. The Amherst High School students, in addition to the Iowa Grant High School students and the Franklin High School students, were here earlier, are part of the Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program by the State Bar Association and the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The students have received materials on this case and may have had lawyers come and appear before them to discuss the case. And the students will meet at noon with Justice Sykes, who is seated at the far left. And next to Justice Sykes is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to my left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice William Babbage. To his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With those introductions made, I will call the second case this morning, 01-33-3324-W, State Ex Rel Norman Brown versus Jody Bradley. Appearing for Mr. Brown is Gregory J. Carmen. Mr. Carmen?
Chief Justice Abrahamson, members of the court, good morning. My name is Attorney Greg J. Carmen, and I represent the petitioner in this matter, Norman O. Brown. A very short rendition of the facts extant in this case is critical to my argument, that being that the tolling rule adopted in State Ex Rel Nichols versus Litcher should receive retroactive application to my client's petition for review, thereby reinstating that petition with this honorable court. On July 6, 2000, the Court of Appeals issued its decision in State versus Norman O. Brown, affirming his convictions on criminal charges originally filed in Dane County. On July 26, 2000, Mr. Brown, proceeding pro se at that juncture, completed his petition for review and gave it to one Darla Rarden, the librarian for the North Fork Correctional Facility, in order for the necessary copies to be made. It took Ms. Rarden a full 5 days to make the copies and return them to Mr. Brown on July 31st, 2000. He, in an expedited fashion, packaged those documents, addressed them correctly for delivery to this court, and paid the postage fee. He included a certificate of mailing with that package, and that was dated August 1st. 8 days later, on August 9th, 2000, this court received Mr. Brown's petition for review and promptly denied it for being 4 days late. I am before this honorable court arguing this case because this court accepted Mr. Brown's petition for writ of habeas corpus and ordered that the sole issue of whether the prison mailbox rule adopted in State Ex Rel Nichols versus Litcher should be applied either retroactively or prospectively, and that that issue be briefed and argued before the court. The state, in my mind, by not choosing to dispute the foregoing chronology that I gave you, has conceded that if the Nichols tolling rule does indeed apply, Mr. Brown's petition would be deemed timely and would be reinstated. That's in the state's brief in chief, page 8.
Page what?
Page 8. In deciding Nichols, this court expressly declined to decide whether it should rule on whether the rule they promulgated there would be applied prospectively or retroactively.
Just read to me on page 8. I'm saying that maybe I'm reading it. This is in the state's brief, page 8. At least in the first paragraph, they're saying that the Nichols tolling rule was adopted on November 6, 2001, exactly 1 year after Brown's conviction became final with expiration of the 90-day period for seeking cert from the U.S. Supreme Court. Consequently, Brown cannot benefit from the Nichols tolling rule unless it is applied retroactively.
What I was...
Yeah, I read the wrong part.
No, not at all. What I am inferring from the state's argument is that they do not anywhere within that brief, in the beginning of the brief, attack the chronology that Mr. Brown applies in his petition for habeas corpus and also the brief filed with the court. And by doing so, what I am saying, I may have inaptly posed it, Justice, what I am saying is that if retroactive application is decided by this court, it would apply to Brown because he is firmly within the prison mailbox rule.
Mr. Carman, if we were to agree with you and apply the mailbox rule retroactively, do you have any estimate as to how many cases would be affected?
Yes, Justice Crooks. I believe in the brief and case in chief, the brief filed by the petitioner, I opined, and it requires some drawing of inference from the court's past practices with regard to accepting cases. And all this case would do by applying it retroactively is to reinstate his petition for review based upon figures in this court with regard to accepting petitions for review somewhere in the 6-7% range. And based on the numbers of cases that I have tallied as asking for relief based upon this type of rule, I would estimate about 7 cases a year.
What, starting at what year?
The figures I used started 10 years ago, Chief Justice, and went up until, I think, December of 2001.
You think there were about 70 cases?
Yes, exactly. Actually, about 100 cases, and I figured that the acceptance rate was about 7%. That's where I came with 7.
Why would you look at just 10 years rather than going back to 1978 with court reorganization?
Well, I think, Justice, that my thought was is that I was looking at something that would be applicable to how the court is constituted now and its past practice in that regard, rather than going back into a situation that may be anachronistic with regard to how the court is handling its cases. At first blush, the threshold issue in this case is whether the civil rules regarding retroactivity, the analysis for civil cases should be applied, or whether it should be the criminal analysis. And of course, the parties differ in their arguments on that question. The statute herein is 808.10 of the Wisconsin statutes. And I argue that nothing within its ambit would lead one to believe that it is either a penal substantive statute or a criminal procedural statute. In fact, its location within chapters 801 to 847 of the Wisconsin statutes would lead one to the opposite conclusion. It is a civil statute contained within the rules of civil procedure. In the Thiel case, the Court of Appeals specifically states that Chapter 980 civil commitment procedures, even though dealing with sexually violent persons who have an underlying conviction for a criminal sexual assault of some sort. Even so, even though dealing with that type of case, it is still subject to the provisions of Chapter 801 to 847, and the Thiel Court specifically provided that the civil analysis for retroactivity should be applied in that event. As stated in the petitioner's brief at page 5, it appears that the state, in the Nichols case, conceded as much, and that at page 33 of the Nichols state's brief, and that the state herein does not argue that the criminal retroactivity analysis is required. Rather, instead, they make the somewhat curious argument that it could reasonably apply to the retroactivity analysis governing new rules of criminal procedure, to the Nichols tolling rule. That's at page 13 of the state's brief. I respectfully submit that, read together, this constitutes a concession by the state that 808.10 is a civil procedural statute, and that the Wisconsin that under Wisconsin precedent, a civil analysis should apply.
Does it really matter which applies?
It does in my mind. I think that Brown wins under either analysis, Chief Justice. But I believe, frankly, that under a civil analysis, he has even a stronger case. I think he has a strong case, of course, in both eventualities. But I think under the civil analysis, which is a three-prong test, all three prongs which are necessary to be met in order to be successful, that Brown meets those three prongs that would apply retroactivity to his case. The case before the court meets the criteria for retroactive application that was first set forth in Chevron Oil versus Houston. That's a 1991 U.S. Supreme Court case, and was previously adopted by this court in Kurtz versus City of Waukesha at 91 West 2nd, 103. That Kurtz rationale was reiterated in the Thiel case, a 2001 case that was just decided last year. The three criteria to be considered in the civil analysis of retroactivity are: one, whether the decision creates a new principle of law, either by overruling clear past precedent on which the parties have relied, or by deciding an issue of first impression.
Go ahead, finish.
One second, thank you. Whose resolution was not clearly foreshadowed.
So yes. Here we have this is a procedural rule. Are you saying this is a new procedural rule?
I think that's been the rule in Wisconsin, Justice, at least since 1991 in the Kurtz case. In the U.S., the Kurtz case was even before that. So it's been precedent in Wisconsin for a number of years.
Counsel, let's look at that first element. Creates new principle of law by either, number one, overruling established precedent, or number two, by deciding a question of first impression that was not foreshadowed. I have paraphrased that.
That's correct.
Did Nichols overrule any existing precedent?
Well, certainly 808.10 has been in existence since, I believe, about 1978 when the court reorganization occurred. It certainly had not applied a prison mailbox rule before the Nichols case was decided. That is not to say, however, that there was an adequate notice that other jurisdictions, including the U.S. Supreme Court, had not considered the issue and decided differently on the prison mailbox rule. That's the Houston v. Lack case,
Let me...
That was 1988 was the decision in that.
Then, to be more specific, did Nichols overrule any existing case law? Your response is...
Not that I could find. The statute has been there on its face. It is applied, of course, procedurally, and certainly there is an avenue for reconsideration that my client and, by the way, Nichols both used to try to get their petitions reconsidered. And usually the next step after that is certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court. Nobody has appealed that specific issue, at least that I found.
Did Nichols establish a question of first impression that was not foreshadowed?
Not in my mind. As I mentioned, the Houston v. Lack case, certainly other jurisdictions, including the High Court, were considering variance, not necessarily always on a petition for review, but on procedural time limits for appeal in any of the number of venues. And they were considering it, and considering it on the basis of fundamental fairness, as to whether or not a prisoner who's precluded from one of the means of filing legal papers before this court, which is personal service, of course, he cannot avail himself of that. He is then at the mercy of the mail system, because that's the only other means, at least at this time, at least at the time Nichols was being decided. Maybe that's something that will be studied later on. But he was at the mercy of the mails, and it's at the mercy of the prison mail system. And the line of cases that have decided that a prison mailbox rule, which essentially is a tolling rule that tolls between the time it's posted and the time it appears, it's filed with the court, they were saying that was necessary from a standpoint of fundamental fairness, because the petitioner had done everything within his or her power to ensure a timely delivery of the papers they were relying on, and something else had intervened, as in this case, something else intervened to make sure, or at least to cause, that those time limits not be met. So the first criteria really was the question that Justice Bradley just posed to me. And the Lack case, in my mind, clearly foreshadowed or adumbrated the ruling in Nichols. And accordingly, I believe that there is no clear break from prior law caused by Nichols, but that it was clearly could have been seen on the horizon at least since 1988. Second, while the issue of how many reopened cases, which we've talked about at least shortly, will occur because of retroactive application should always be seriously considered by any court that's interested in the administration of justice, as this court is, the way the court structures retroactivity will always have an impact on the scope of the prophylactic effect of any rule. In Thiel, the court limited retroactivity to non-final cases. We believe that stringent limit would be inequitable in the case before the court. And a reasonable time limit for retroactivity, as for instance proposed by Justice Souter and Graham v. Collins, a five-year look-back period, would seem to be reasonable, especially given the figures that Justice Brooks and I discussed a few minutes ago.
Now, did those figures come from the clerk of the Supreme Court?
That's correct.
On what, the number of pro ses?
Pro se. Well, I had to winnow through them and find out which pro se case. They did provide me with the pro se cases, but I looked for pro se cases that were denied for time limit violations specifically.
Okay. Thank you.
This is a very limited rule. All it does, as I stated before, is toll the time limit for the filing deadline in a very limited number of instances where petitions are filed by pro se prisoners. The state's argument that it would be hard to rebut a prisoner's argument that he delivered his petition timely and that the state would have difficulty in rebutting that, I believe, is simply unpersuasive.
Why is that?
Thank you. Justice, I believe that is because, as the state concedes in its brief, the petitioner herein is in an enviable position, and that is he included an affidavit of mailing, and he included also an affidavit from Darla Rarden, who I mentioned before, that corroborates his chronology in this case. And what I'm saying is that this court certainly can put limits on its retroactivity. And one of the limits it certainly could put is we're only going to apply this to cases where there's clear proof of a chronology through either an affidavit of mailing or an affidavit from somebody in the prison system.
And how long are these records kept then? Let's say, are they kept for 5 years? Are they kept for 10?
At the prison, are you referring to, Justice?
Well, I'm just wondering how we're going to ascertain this.
I know, if you asked what would happen with regard to a Wisconsin prisoner, I believe they would comply with the open records law and they would be around at least for 7 years. But this prisoner is incarcerated in Texas, and I'm not aware of what the rule would be in Texas in that regard. Thank you. No one has sought to seek to disprove the petitioner's averments that he... that the chronology was as stated in his petition his petition for writ of habeas corpus, and also in the petitioner's brief in this matter. As I stated, the court can ensure that the state is not inordinately prejudiced by requiring an affidavit of mailing accompany any petition that is mailed. That certainly is a general practice by somebody who's represented by counsel if they avail themselves of mailing, although most counsel, I would suspect, personally serve their papers to ensure they're there on time. It certainly is something that, if we're going to allow that sort of instance to occur for pro se prisoners, retroactivity could be based upon that affidavit of mailing. Also, it is something that can be considered, but now in our new electronic age, maybe electronic filing is something that can be utilized by pro se prisoners. The chronologies provided in the brief by the petitioner shows that he and Nichols could not be more similarly situated. In fact, the petition for review filed by Mr. Brown, for which he seeks reinstatement of his petition, was actually filed some 5 months after Nichols filed his petition for review. Nichols' petition, of course, was reinstated by the action of this court in the Nichols case. The Thiel court, in contrast to the state's argument herein, required a two-pronged consideration of the possible inequities of not applying, of retroactivity, either both on the administration of justice, which we've talked about to fairly extensively here today, but also on the public. The test ensures that mere negative impact on the Wisconsin court system is not enough standing alone to require application of this rule prospectively. But the petitioner, as I've argued previously, does not concede a negative impact on this course. The court, we've already discussed the number of cases I believe would be reconsidered if this rule was in effect. Moreover, the state and Nichols argued that there was no sound policy reasons for extending the prison mailbox rule to pro se prisoners who did not contemporaneously complain about the timeliness of their petitions for review. That's at page 33 of the state's brief in Nichols. Under any widely embraced definition of the term contemporaneous, Brown is intertwined with the same chronology as is Nichols. It is important to note that Brown was complaining about the timeliness of his petition before the Nichols petition for writ of habeas corpus was ever accepted. I would finally like to talk for a couple of minutes about the criminal analysis for retroactivity, because there are two separate analyses. This is, of course, an argument in the alternative. The petitioner believes that the Thiel analysis for civil...
Before you do that, counsel, one of the things that the court might or might not consider is, and you've alluded to it, the number of cases we're going to have to deal with. You indicate maybe it's 100 cases. Do you know of any cases in which we've allowed a late filing under any of these rules, or the Court of Appeals has allowed a late filing, where we gave substantive relief? That is, it's you win, but then you lose.
Yes, in fact, while it wasn't the Thiel case, I believe the Thiel case cited a Wisconsin case that stated essentially that if we were going to apply the rule retroactively, we would apply it to this case, but we've looked at the petition and we wouldn't have accepted the petition.
I mean, I don't have an absolute total recollection of all the cases, obviously, but I can't remember any that we allowed a late filing for one reason or another, and then held for the defendant.
That could well be the case, because people using the good common sense that the Lord endowed them with will oftentimes look at the merits of the petition and see if that's dispositive.
Well, that's all you're asking for, isn't it, for the court to look at the merits of this petition?
Absolutely.
You already got your right of review in the Court of Appeals. You lost there.
Exactly.
What percent of these criminal cases do we overturn?
Between 6% and 7% are accepted. Less are overturned.
Obviously.
90%, I believe, was the last figure I looked at cases that were affirmed once they were accepted.
In the criminal area?
Yes, in the criminal area.
Less in the civil area?
Probably, yes.
What I'm trying to get at is, one, should a court put into this hopper the equation of retroactivity, a flood of litigation? That's my first question. My second question is, if they do, is this a flood or is it a little trickle?
Certainly, any time retroactivity is entertained, Chief Justice, there is the possibility of a flood, just because of the amount of cases that a state court administers in a year. But everything that I have read and studied and the figures I received from the Supreme Court indicates to me that there is no inundation based upon the Nichols precedent, that it would be a trickle, and that about 100 cases per year that would be reviewed or at least initially scrutinized on the petition for review, and only about 7 that would be accepted.
I'm sorry, I've used the rest of your time.
I see.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you.
I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General James Frymuth, representing the respondent state official in this original habeas action. Two questions for the court are First, the retroactivity of the Nichols tolling rule, whether it should be applied prospectively or retroactively, and then second, whether Mr. Brown can make use of the tolling rule to have his late filed petition for review entertained by this court. The state's position is as follows. Regardless of which retroactivity analysis is used, civil or criminal, the Nichols tolling rule should apply only to two categories of cases. First, to cases that were not final on November 6, 2001, which is the date of the decision of the Nichols case. And secondly, to pro se prisoners who had habeas petitions still pending in this court on that date, November 6, 2001, in which the prisoner clearly had argued for the mailbox rule. Under these standards, Mr. Brown could not make use of the Nichols tolling rule to save his late arriving petition for review because his appeal was no longer on direct review when Nichols was decided. In fact, it had become final exactly one year before Nichols was decided. Also, Mr. Brown had no habeas petition seeking a mailbox rule still pending in this court when Nichols was decided. It is true that in October 2000, at the same time this court was considering Nichols' habeas petition on the subject of a mailbox rule, Mr. Brown also had raised the issue, but this court denied Mr. Brown's effort ex parte.
What date was that? When was that filed also, while you're looking at?
Mr. Brown's habeas petition, I believe, was filed there's two things that he did. After his petition for review was initially dismissed, he moved for reconsideration. And that was on September 5th, 2000. That was approximately a month after it was denied as untimely.
Okay.
Then approximately another month later, and then that motion was denied, the motion for reconsideration. And then on October 3rd, 2000, Mr. Brown again asked for essentially what this court called another motion for reconsideration. And in that, at the end of that document, he referenced the Shimkus Court of Appeals case, which had just come down approximately a week or so earlier.
And we denied that?
And you denied that ex parte.
What date?
On October 5th, 2000. Okay. And then it was December of 2000 when you entertained Mr. Nichols' motion for reconsideration, and that got the briefing started in that case.
When did Mr. Nichols file?
Mr. Nichols' habeas petition was his petition for review was dismissed as untimely on February 20th, 2000. Then his habeas petition, I don't have the filing date here, but it was denied ex parte on September 12th of 2000. Then he moved to reconsideration on September 28th of 2000, 2 weeks later. And then in December is when this court granted the motion for reconsideration and briefing was done in that case.
So we were very consistent with Mr. Nichols and Mr. Brown, at least as of September and October of 2000, right?
I think so.
But then something happened in December 2000 where the court saw a different light.
Correct.
And so it then moved along and ultimately held for Nichols.
Correct. The mailbox rule was adopted, right?
And had we held, had we known or put together Nichols and Brown and held them together and packaged them, Brown would be at least have available the Nichols rule.
That's correct. I believe so.
Just like we've packaged together another case with this one. Let's see. We held in abeyance Farmer versus Bradley. You aware of that?
No, I wasn't.
Pardon?
I was not aware of that.
Held in abeyance pending this court's decision. Farmer filed a petition for habeas under Nichols. And he says if it's retroactively applied, he's is okay.
The only thing I can say the difference is that perhaps in October of 2000, when Mr. Brown's effort at having a mailbox rule applied to him, this court did not see that it was either, you know, adequately argued, or that for whatever reason the merits just did not catch the court's attention at that time until Mr. Nichols' situation.
Counsel,
Chief, go ahead, I'm done.
Counsel, as I have a chart on these dates. In September of 2000, with regard to Brown, we denied his motion for reconsideration. And we also denied in September of 2000 Nichols' petition for writ of habeas corpus. And then what happened later in that September of 2000, that is on September 14th of 2000, the Shimkus case was decided. And within a few weeks of Shimkus, Brown asked us to reconsider the denial of his motion for reconsideration, citing Shimkus. And lo and behold, Nichols asks us to reconsider our denial of his habeas petition 3 weeks, about 3 weeks after Shimkus. So Brown asked 2 weeks after Shimkus, Nichols asked 3 weeks after Shimkus. And we denied Brown on October 6th, but we granted Nichols' request for reconsideration on December 12th, both of the same year, 2000. Brown wasn't satisfied, according to my chart. And so Brown, after we denied him on October 6th, petitioned the United States Supreme Court on November 6th of 2000. So it seems to me, if those dates that I have are correct, that you have the Shimkus decision on September 14th. In both cases, we had previously denied their motions for reconsideration or their petition for habeas corpus. Within 2 weeks of Shimkus, Brown asked us to reconsider. Within 3 weeks of Shimkus, Nichols asked us to reconsider. We said no to Brown. He took it to the United States Supreme Court, but we said yes to Nichols. So
The only answer I can give you for that is that the mailbox rule itself wasn't so clearly, what's the word, so clear that it should be adopted. Firsthand, I know from initially responding in the Nichols case, the state took the position that the mailbox rule could not be read into, for example, the word filing in 808.10, and that the state couldn't see how the court could get a mailbox rule read into the statute, and that if it was going to be adopted, perhaps formal rulemaking was the route to go.
In fact, that's what Shimkus did. That's the very thing that Shimkus said. We said, well, we can't read, I think, if I recall. Filing isn't part of the words of the statute, and it would make us choke to have to go that far to read it in, and so we're going to toll instead.
Right.
And indeed, that's what Nichols, explaining the choke rationale of Shimkus, did the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I think it was still broiling, if you will, or trying a decision as to whether this really should be applied in this context in petitions for review, and that for whatever reason Nichols captured the court's attention more readily than Mr. Brown did. I'm not suggesting that it would be necessarily totally fair to not have Mr. Brown encompassed with Mr. Nichols, given these factual history of this. It's just that I think that whenever a court is going to apply something retroactively, there's always going to be perhaps a category of cases where the issue had perhaps been raised somewhat before but did not capture the court's attention. And the question becomes, how far back do you go then if you're going to allow all those people who may have to some degree or another raised that issue? When you're dealing with rules of retroactivity, that's a tricky proposition. And I think in the criminal context in particular, and the Schmelzer case is the one that I cite for the criminal, in the criminal context, Schmelzer is real similar to this case in that it was another exception, if you will, to the requirement of the 30-day filing period for a petition for review. In Schmelzer, this court recognized the statutory right to ineffective assistance of counsel, at least with respect to that filing. But in Schmelzer, this court also recognized that this was something that was being developed here in a collateral action, a habeas action. And it concluded that under Teague, this was not the type of situation because of the nature of discretionary review, because the prisoner had his full review in the Court of Appeals or the opportunity for that, that this was, the T criteria were not met. This was not something so fundamental to the fairness of a underlying conviction that it said, we'll apply it to Mr. Schmelzer because his litigation is the one that's fair. His litigation and expense is the one that caused the court to enact the rule. But we're going to cut it off there and only apply, and there's the limited category of exceptions is to those pro se prisoners who may have asked at the same time and still had a petition with raising that issue that was still pending in this court. It hadn't been rejected for whatever reason before then. And I think for retroactivity purposes, that's the analysis that the state is suggesting applies here. The difficulty I have is how far back are you going to go then if you're going to include Mr. Brown?
What's the matter with going back to 1978?
I think
the burden is on the defendant.
Sorry?
The burden is on the defendant to show there was compliance with the prison rules, the institution's rules.
Right.
You have some, but not many, pro ses. In fact, pro ses have increased dramatically, I think, in the last, say, 8 years, at least by my rough calculations. Do you agree?
I think so. I can only give you anecdotal from my job. But
we now call it anecdata.
Anecdata.
Okay. And my anecdata, and I keep count on this when we do the petitions, is it's increased, whether it's 8 years or 9 years or seven, but within that time span. And your anecdata is roughly the same. Okay. From my anecdata, of those pro ses, very few deal with the time period. I mean, I can't even tell you how many deal with that. Can you?
You're talking about habeas petitions raising?
Habeas or petitions to review that have been denied on that ground initially and then a habeas.
I can't say in terms of round numbers how many petitions have been denied because they were late filed by pro se prisoners.
They're usually dismissed, not
dismissed,
denied.
Dismissed, I mean, dismissed. And the habeas petitions, this Nichols and Brown were the only two that I was aware of. I think the difficulty with going back far, and whether you're looking at this in terms of criminal retroactivity or civil, in a criminal case, if you go back too far, first, the justification is questionable because the number of cases that the court is actually going to first accept and then grant relief to a defendant is going to be small. That cuts both ways. But beyond that, if there is a case that goes back 20 years, and for whatever reason that petition might have some merit that this court would take it, it's difficult for the state at that time. I guess it depends on the individual case, but there could be problems with witnesses.
We're not trying it. This is just appellate review. It's a question of law. You haven't even gotten a reversal yet.
Right. I guess the best I can give you is just that the potential problem of proof the farther back you go in time increases, both in terms
defendant.
Of challenging.
Defendant.
Excuse
for
me.
The defendant. The burden is on the defendant.
Although, that's true. That's true. But the state may have difficulty if the defendant comes up with a document that purports to be a certificate of mailing, and the state has a difficult, may have a difficult time if there are no prison login records to refute that.
I just want to chime in here. Opposing counsel indicated that he thought that they kept the records for, quote, 7 years. Now, I don't know where that came from, but what we've had since 78, we've tripled the prison population, at least, or more, and we've built new prisons, etc. I'm just wondering about the administrative concerns. Do you know, as a matter of fact, how long they keep these?
I do not know. All I know is that when Nichols was being argued, I investigated what the mail login system was, the login for outgoing mail. And at that time, almost unanimously, I think, if not unanimously, they did not record outgoing mail from prisoners. So the proof issue is going to be one of the inmate coming up with a certificate of mailing or an affidavit from a prison official saying that this is when I gave it to the official for mailing.
And that would be if I gave it to the prison official in 1986. That would be...
It would be difficult to challenge that, I think. I mean, I suppose, and there is another aspect to this, I suppose, and that is, even if you're going to go back into how far back in time you go with the mailbox rule, our position is that the particular individual should have at least raised that issue at some point in the process as well, to be fair. I think that might be one way, perhaps, of ameliorating how far back in time you go. If you also require proof that the inmate prisoner had asked this court for something like a mailbox rule, or that there was something in the prison process that caused the late receipt of the petition for review.
That would be at least eliminate some of the
proof problems.
There was a suggestion, so if it's a proof problem and a time problem, opposing counsel indicated, well, what about going back 5 years and saying, all right, it's an arbitrary, seems to be an arbitrary cutoff, but...
I think that's part of the problem, is there's always going to be somebody who could say, well, why didn't you count me? You know, I was 5 years and 2 days outside of it, and I even raised the issue. So that's the difficult problem. And I think the way this court answered retroactivity in Schmelzer is the way that it should approach it here, just for all these same considerations really are at play here, and that is just what we've been talking about. And there's no reason to really go back in time where, at least in the case of criminal convictions, the inmate has had at least the opportunity for a full review in criminal appeals.
What do we do if it's a father in prison who files a petition for a TPR which isn't criminal? Then how are you going to suggest that we follow Schmelzer, which is decidedly criminal in procedure and substance?
Well, I think if you look at the same criteria, I mean, if you look at the civil criteria, you come to the same result. It's a way, I guess, of how valuable, going how far back in time, how valuable it's going to be to do that, where the benefit of doing that is arguably minimal. I don't know enough about the civil context apart from, say, the prison administrative stuff, which I'd like to say is, if you went back in prison administration stuff so far back, it's probably not going to have any value to the prisoner because the discipline action is going to be done with. The TPR, I'm not sure enough about the procedures and whether, how far back in time, whether that's going to really matter. But the common thing in all this is a finality. At some point, the process has got to stop and got to end. And at some point, there's a case that's going to turn on the light bulb, if you will, for a new rule of procedure that perhaps, you know, is warranted. But
that, the question I ask gets to, I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me, do Schmelzer, and yet, yet my concern is the Nichols case is not limited to criminal cases. And there are civil cases where petitions for review can be given to the proper authority at the prison and time blown, so to speak. And so it just seems awfully hard to justify in a civil case applying criminal retroactivity analysis.
The two answers that occur to me is the Supreme Court having now said we're going to follow the Griffith standard, which is the non-final, applied only to non-final cases. And they're doing that. In Harper, they said we're going to do that with civil. So whatever reasoning the Supreme Court found persuasive in Harper to say we're going to follow the Griffith retroactivity principle, which means only non-final cases, cases still in the appellate pipeline.
We did that in Cook. That was in the 48-hour rule. Okay.
Except that I think this court has not yet paired the Cook is the criminal retroactivity. I don't think this court has yet paired the criminal with the civil. And the Kurtz is the last, I think, pronouncement of this court on the civil standard. In my brief, I didn't argue that for the same standard to apply across the board to criminal and civil, but I would suggest that Harper would be the case that would supply the rationale for doing that, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case.
And what is that rationale?
I really don't know Harper that well to tell you what it is. I'm sorry. I'd have to look back at it. My guess is that they're looking again at finality and the number of cases that are going to be excluded when you apply that either are not going to be a large number, perhaps, or that the looking at the particular action. I'm sorry, in the civil arena, I have a little trouble with the procedures, but I'm assuming the same kind of rationale would apply as in the criminal, in that the further back in time you go, you've got either proof problems or the potential remedy for the plaintiff in a civil action may no longer exist. That type of concern, I think. Beyond that, without looking at Harper closely again, I couldn't tell you.
Well, assuming that those are correct articulations of the rationale in Harper, how do those play out in this instance?
In Mr. Brown's specific case?
Well,
or in
general, right. If we apply the tolling rule across the board.
Well, I think the first question is how far back you're going to go, because that engenders how proof problems and potential proof problems. So I think that's the first question.
Are the proof problems limited to proof of compliance with Nichols, or are there also proof problems on the underlying merits that we should be discussing?
Exactly. It's certainly in the criminal area. I mean, if you're talking about a conviction from 1980, for example, and now this inmate should come up with proof that that the prison officials, he gave it to them in a certain date. If you look at the underlying criminal case, there may be, if it's so old, it almost, in this court, if this court said, okay, we'll look at his petition for review, and then you look at that, and it's a 20-year-old conviction. I think within that context, at least, you'd have to consider the merits of whether there are witnesses, what the particular issue is.
But we look at legal issues, counsel.
Pardon?
We look at the legal issues here, right? maybe there was a total violation of the right to counsel. Let's just take that. And that it's just absolutely clear under the law that his right to counsel was violated. It's right on the face of all the documents and it slipped through, right?
Okay.
Do we then look to see whether we reverse on this constitutional error that was not harmless by definition? Do we look to see just whether the state has a tough time proving it?
That's a difficult question. I don't have a real, at the top of my head, good answer for it, other than to say that at some point, if it's a criminal case and the defendant had the opportunity for the direct appeal review, even if, I mean, mistakes get made. I'm not saying they don't. And this court's...
directly appealed.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. The Court of Appeals held against him in a per curiam.
Right.
It was a petition for review here, and it was late. And there's absolute proof that he mailed it within the mailbox. So now we look at the petition for review, and we have an absolute legal issue.
It's a hard question because I think, certainly on a common sense level, you want to be fair to the particular individual. But if the procedural rules that were in place at that time did not permit a person to file that petition without doing so timely, I mean, I guess I would hope that if there really was a striking example of unfairness in a criminal case or a civil case, that the pro se prisoner would immediately act on it by asking this court to look further at it and not sit on it. Now, I'm not saying that it couldn't happen. It's a difficult question. I don't have a better answer for you than at some point I think you have to say this is the end of it.
Innocent or guilty, with or without counsel?
Within the procedural framework. And I know this is what we're talking about, is how far back should this procedure go to capture this?
So we're going to recognize, we have to, in my assumption, say he's got proof positive that he deposited within the prison. Timely.
Well, I'm thinking perhaps there's a habeas action that might, a different vehicle that might lie to capture the cases that have a clear constitutional violation. I mean, our system isn't such that...
Isn't that the question? He or she isn't out of luck. They may be in that area of retroactivity or the mailbox rule, but certainly when you're talking constitutional rights, they can bring a petition.
Correct.
They being the prisoner, isn't it?
Correct. Right. I think there is a vehicle. I mean, our system hopefully isn't so narrow that it can't correct an injustice in a particular case where a vehicle for doing so like habeas is available, and that's what habeas is for.
Well, isn't that, what am I missing? Isn't that what this case is all about? Because he did bring a petition for writ of habeas in September of 2000 on the Shimkus issue, and we denied it, the petition for habeas, and he petitioned for cert on that denial to the United States Supreme Court. So are you suggesting that he can now file, I mean, isn't this a petition for habeas here? Or what do we hear on procedural?
Well, in Nichols, I think part of the concern was, and the constitutionality of a mailbox rule was discussed, and
I was talking about Brown.
I know, I understand. If you're going to start looking at cases case by case, that's difficult to do in terms of a mailbox rule, because either they were timely or they weren't, and if there is some constitutional concern, they could raise that as like a due process concern. But if we're just talking about a procedural rule, and the only claim is that the procedural rule should go so far back in time to capture me, I think the merits of the particular case probably don't dictate the retroactivity analysis. Otherwise, you're doing exactly what the U.S. Supreme Court was trying to avoid in Harper, and that is this case-by-case retroactivity approach, and do it as a blanket rule.
Counsel, could Mr. Brown file another petition with this court? I mean, there's no, he could. I'm just trying to make up from I understand what his argument was. Could he refile with this court, or is he out?
With this court, a petition for
review? I'm talking, habeas. Right, habeas.
I think his underlying issues dealt with plea agreement breach, and I think if there was a constitutional concern there of due process, that upon an adequate showing, he'd have to make an adequate showing why he did not. Well, the underlying merits probably are, he's probably going to have a hard time because the underlying merits of that issue were addressed in his direct appeal. And so he could present it by habeas petition, but I think he's going to end up in, at least I would argue, in the same position that he was when he had his direct appeal on that issue.
How many habeas can he bring? Is he out under the Prisoner Litigation Act?
Petitions
can he bring?
Right, there's a three strikes rule, I know, for that, and I'm not sure how habeas plays into that or not. I just don't know.
The other issue, and I've now forgotten the name of the case, that says you got to bring everything at one time, because if you don't, you're out anyway.
Escalona?
Pardon me?
Escalona?
Escalona, of course.
The 974.
It's a double name, Escalona what?
Naranjo.
Right.
Orange.
So how about that? How many times can he bring things?
He can bring it as long as he has a good reason why he didn't do it before. So there's no end per se, but he has to come up with a good reason.
Got a case pending on that now. On the Escalona, right?
I'm not sure.
So unless he has a good reason, and what's the good reason that the court made a mistake? Court didn't treat him the way they treated somebody else 2 months later. November, December, 2 months later.
If he were to bring another habeas petition now, saying that,
you'd object to that, wouldn't you?
We would.
You objected to the mailbox rule. Now you're objecting to its retroactivity.
Well, we didn't. We didn't object totally to the mailbox rule. We flipped sides on that when we argued.
The counsel and Nickel. You were the counsel.
I was. Initially, we objected, thinking that it couldn't be done without formal rulemaking, and then the tolling aspect of it. We did not dispute the policy reasons for it.
Well, we could have done it by rulemaking. I mean, but we chose to use the other vehicle.
We just adopted the mailbox rule in, I think it's two briefs, by rulemaking.
Right. I see my time's winding down. I'll just summarize my position once more, as I said at the outset. Regardless of which analysis is applied, the Nichols tolling rule should apply only to two categories: cases that were non-final when Nichols was decided on November 6, 2001. That would include, for example, cases in which cert review to the U.S. Supreme Court was still available. And secondly, to pro se prisoners who had habeas petitions still pending when Nichols was decided, and in which the prisoner argued for the mailbox rule. Under these standards, unfortunately, Mr. Brown could not make use of the Nichols tolling rule. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frymuth. Counsel, you have a few moments in rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. With the court's indulgence, first of all, I'd like to correct a misstatement I made in my initial comments to the court. I did look at the pro se report that I got from the court clerk with regard to cases that was dated from January 1st of 1996, so it was a 6-year look back, not a 10-year look back. Just looking at 1996 on the first page, there appears to be about 6 cases that utilized late filing. 97 was somewhat less.
Were they all pro ses?
These are all pro se cases. Obviously, there's a different dynamic when counsel is involved because he has another... Okay. We talked about final cases a little bit. I'd like to argue that this is a species of non-final case because his petition was rejected almost simultaneously. There was a one-year lapse between his case being final under the U.S. Supreme Court rule for finalization and the Nichols case being decided, but there was less than 6 months, about 5 months, between when the Nichols writ was accepted and between when my client's case was filed.
Mr. Carman, when was your client's petition to the U.S. Supreme Court turned down?
I did not even know, I didn't receive any materials, and in my searching of the record, I didn't even know that he filed for a writ of cert on this case. So this is the first time I heard it when this court mentioned it. Certainly, if he did do so, the finalization period would squeeze somewhat more. I'm sure under the U.S. Supreme Court's definition of finalization, after that certiorari petition was denied, it would be deemed final at that point. I don't believe a case-by-case analysis is necessarily required. That is not to say that I don't believe that substantial fairness and justice in some cases doesn't require a case-by-case analysis. But in this instance, this court can set reasonable criteria with regard to what is necessary from a proof standpoint for somebody to plead the mailbox rule.
So what is the criteria?
Well, one of the criteria is that an affidavit of mailing be accompany all mailed petitions for review. If the court wants another level...
Even one back from 86?
Well, I mean, I guess what I would argue in that case, Justice, is that I just don't foresee a lot of petitions coming on this basis from 1986. And first of all, as learned counsel for the opposition has stated, most of those people have vacated the premises, so to speak.
Let's say 96.
I think that if you are going to place criteria and you believe it to be a reasonable criteria in order to winnow through the chaff, so to speak, 1996, you may require it, yes. And that may obviate success on the part of some petitioners. But at this point, a strict finalization concept obviates it for almost all. No, I will amend that and say all who use collateral review.
I guess
because they're using collateral review because their case has been finalized.
Who would keep that affidavit of mailing? Who kept that? The prisoner?
The prisoner in this instance did.
The prisoner, okay.
But in the same token, there is nothing that would prevent that affidavit of mailing being appended with the petition as an exhibit to the petition. And certainly, as I mentioned before, electronic filing may be something that you want to consider in that regard.
Would there be a basis for distinguishing a petition for review in a civil case from a criminal case?
Well, certainly, there is the major difference, and that's the liberty interest of the individual involved. That's what you're implicating on this type of appellate process, is the right for somebody to go before a forum and be heard with regard to what he or she believes is an unfair application of the rules that causes him to have his body in incarceration. Writ of habeas corpus, bring that body forth. And I think that certainly dictates more scrutiny with regard to somebody who is incarcerated as opposed to somebody who has lost property interest in a civil case.
Well, the mailbox rule doesn't apply until you've got an incarcerated person. So you can have a civil case where there's a divorce case, for example, which is civil. Guy's incarcerated, so you might get that issue coming up if he were this petition.
Yes.
Wouldn't you apply the same rules?
I would apply.
You're asking for the civil rules anyway.
That's correct. And I certainly am not going to eschew that argument that at this point because I think it's the appropriate argument in this case. I don't believe, if anything, and you use your common instincts with regard to how cases proceed through the court and are appealed, one would assume there would be less in the way of civil appeals than there would be criminal appeals on this type of issue. Finally, I would say we talked about turning on the light bulb, and in the American system of jurisprudence, that is the way in which we recognize the inequity in our procedures and, in turn, build confidence in our institutions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carman. Thank you, Mr. Freiman, for your argument this morning in 01-3324W, State Ex Rel Norman Brown versus Jody Bradley. The students will remain.